JJ, you talked about your close calls this year and how adversity is a really, really good teacher. What are those lessons that you drew from that really helped you bring it across the finish line today?
I just felt like you keep putting yourself in these positions, like eventually you're gonna tick one off. I don't put myself in this position often or at all for a major, that's for sure. I mean, like this is only my second US Open. But all the close calls that I've had on the PGA Tour this year, it's just been a really good experience to just never give up. And actually, like, I was thinking about, I was having lunch with Max Homa at home. We live in the same area. We belong at the same club. And he was telling a Tiger story where he's like, as long as you just, like, are still there, like, just, you don't have to do anything crazy, especially at a US Open. He's like, Tiger said this would happen, and, you know, the wind will switch, but you just got to just stay there. Like, even if you're four back, like, you just got to stay there. Like, you don't have to do anything crazy. And I kind of was thinking about that out there this afternoon where, you know, I was four back, maybe going back out after the delay. And then, you know, I made some good pars, nothing crazy, and got a really good birdie. And then next thing you know, I'm, like, tied for lead, I think. And, you know, within four holes of the restart. So that just kind of goes back to that. Like, you just try to just stay there. Like, you don't have to do anything crazy, especially at a US Open. So all those things came true. I think when you start to put expectation and that adds pressure, and you start putting, you know, you just don't want to have that extra pressure. And you can do that easily by letting your mind wander, and what if this, and if I do this, what happens? And I used to do that all the time. Like, oh, if I win, like, I can get into the Masters. If I do this, I, you know, lock my card up for 2 years, or blah, blah, blah. And then I just started saying, like, you know, my career is my career. Like, whatever happens, happens. I'm just happy to have the career that I've had. And that's kind of took a lot of pressure off my back as far as expectations on the golf course. And, you know, I mean, last year in June, I was like looking like I was going to lose my job. And kind of that was when I had that moment where, you know, if this is how I go out, well, I might as well go down swinging. It's kind of how my coach tells me about my golf shots, or like my golf swing on the course. Like, if it's a challenging shot, he's like, at least you go down committing to the shot. Like, don't bail one outright because you feel uncomfortable. He's like, just go down swinging. Like, if you're going to, you might as well put the swing you want on it, and if it doesn't work out, then it doesn't work out. And that's kind of the mantra I've been having all year.
But Spawn finds himself on a pretty elite list. Only five men in history have ever held a solo 18-hole lead in a major championship and went on to win. Of course, Tiger Woods did it twice. Retief Goosen, Rory McIlroy, Martin Kaymer was the last one, but Pinehurst back in 2014. And now, of course, JJ Spawn. And we're joined now by Golf Channel senior writers Rex Hoggard, Ryan Lavner, who we affectionately think of as the dollar store version of Chambly and McGinley, but we're happy to have them here on this Monday morning. Rex, I want to start with you. Were you surprised, having covered so many of these majors over the years, that a guy was able to reset in the way he was? Because those first six holes looked as though JJ Spawn was entirely out of this tournament.
He was finished.
Yeah.
I think when you look at the way some other people went the other way, Sam Burns being the primary example, where after the delay, it seemed like he wasn't right. He didn't like the conditions. The golf course had changed. Now go to JJ Spawn, where you're right. He completely reset. I was talking with his caddy, and when they blew the horn, when the storm came through, he actually kind of started high-fiving. There was a moment where he was so happy that, oh, I get to reset. I get to go to the locker room. He changed clothes. He took a deep breath. His swing coach, Adam Schreiber, went. They had a talk. They talked about everything that went wrong. Had a chance to address those first six holes, where I've never seen a golfer get that many bad breaks over the course of six holes. And I think he did reset. I've never seen it like that
before.
Do
you think it actually helps that it were bad breaks rather than bad shots?
I think it 100%. And it goes back to the idea that he knew coming into this he was going to have to respond or react. That was Adam Shriver's sort of idea for the week. You're going to get a bad break. You're going to end up in the rough. You're going to end up in a difficult situation. What's important? Are you going to respond to it? Or are you going to react to it? And he did it all day long.
I'll also say the similarities were striking to what happened at the Players' Championship. You know, slightly different scenario, but at least there he had the 54-hole lead, played pretty poorly on that opening nine. Again, had another delay, reset, came back out, late in the afternoon where he was able to make some birdies. Also, just like at the U.S. Open, had the lead come back to him. I think sort of stacking the experiences that J.J. Spahn has had over the past year was certainly beneficial for him.
Did you expect to hear from J.J. Spahn in 2025 post-Players' Championship? Had you written him off? Was he high in your notebook? Was he deep in your notebook? How much were you tracking him after his duel with Rory?
I mean, quite frankly, he hadn't done a whole lot. I think he had a good week at Colonial, but he had been certainly pretty quiet. I think when you have the skill set that J.J. Spahn does, there's particular golf courses on which he's going to thrive. We've seen it so far at the Sony Open this year. We've seen it at the Cognizant Classic this year. We've seen it at TPC Sawgrass. Those are sort of position-oriented golf courses, A to B. Did not necessarily see it at Oakmont, but for at least the first 54 holes, he really got by with timely iron play, elite scrambling, and elite putting. Obviously, you look at the last seven holes, that was what sort of carried him through. But it wasn't necessarily the recipe for success. Traditionally, this has been a ball-striking fiesta. Greens in regulation is traditionally the most important metric. That wasn't what got J.J. Spahn this victory.
On the subject of this golf course, Rex, it is famously difficult. And usually when we have a difficult golf course, there's a certain amount of whining tends to emanate from the locker room. And it was strikingly absent this week. The players were not complaining about it. Do you think that's a sign that the USGA got it right in terms of the course setup, difficult as it was?
I was on the elevator last night in the hotel with a USGA official, and I said that's the ultimate compliment. The fact that you weren't in the media, the fact I didn't have to talk to you this week, because as you pointed out, the players didn't whine. They didn't whine about how fast the greens were or how thick the rough is. This is such a hard golf course. You said amazingly hard. I'm going to go with comically hard. Like, when you actually walk around that place, you wonder, why do people play here the other 51 weeks out of the year? Because it's that difficult. And for the best players in the world to come out here, and to your point, Eamon, what they do best is complain sometimes and not to say a word, yeah, that's the ultimate compliment.
It hosted a record 10th U.S. Open. I want to talk about the finish laugh specifically. I mean, John Rahm birdied his last two at Torrey Pines, Tom Watson, 82, at Pebble Beach. Where does this finish on 17 and 18 stand up in your mind in U.S. Open history?
I mean, it has to be up there. I'm having a hard time sort of wrapping my head around where else you would sort of place it in the pantheon. And I think it really goes down to there were so many other sort of confluence of events, the chaos and the carnage and even the whiff of controversy with Sam Burns being denied a ruling on 15. And then I think when you had everything else, you still had clutch shots. I think that's what made this such a satisfying U.S. Open, because had it sort of worked out differently, had there been sort of a late collapse on the 17th or 18th, I think we'd be sitting here with sort of a different feeling. But the fact that he stepped up on 17, hit the shot of his life, at least what we thought was the shot of his life, and then on 18, I would argue, was actually even more impressive. The seed that he hit, 308 yards in a pretty steady rain, a little left-to-right peeler right into the heart of the fairway, knowing full well that if you miss that fairway, statistically, that is a one-shot penalty. That was incredibly impressive. Those 30 minutes were arguably the best in U.S. Open history.
Mm. Now, given the difficulty and the conditions everyone faced out there, and just on the course, and then you add the weather on top, does it make it a little easier or a little less disappointing for some of the guys who were in that mix and didn't leave with a trophy? Because everyone was hanging on for dear life for 18 holes. No one really you can point to and say, well, that guy just lost the tournament. He just gave it away, because they were all just trying to keep their head above water.
Yeah, and I think when you look at the circumstances that some of the contenders, the sort of the ways in which they lost, like Adam Scott caught a sort of a water flyer from the middle of the fairway on 11. Terrell Hatton thought he was going to be in a good position after his tee shot on 17 in the big mouth bunker, instead sort of hangs up in the rough. Sam Burns denied a ruling, ended up costing him a double bogey on 15. Terrell Hatton had a great moment when he was in flash, where he was sort of ruing and lamenting the chances that had gone by for him. He's clearly looking at a TV just off, and he says, oh, he's made it. So that sort of, that provided him at least a little bit of solace, that someone went out and won it. And although the scores were high on that second nine, I don't think anyone necessarily lost it. I think the golf course was just pushed to the brink, and they certainly pushed these players to the brink as well.
Well, Lav and Rex are going to hang around and continue this segment right after the break. In the meantime, here are a few images of J.J. Spahn, your 125th United States Open champion at Oakmont Country Club. We're back in golf today as we take a look at some incredible images from the conclusion of the 125th US Open. JJ Spaun now up to number 8 in the official world golf ranking and a first-time major winner. The birdie finish to fight that trophy. And he also started the week pretty good as well. Oakmont Country Club doesn't give up many bogey-free rounds. Dustin Johnson back in 2016 did it. It was the only bogey-free round out of 400-odd rounds played that year at Oakmont Country Club. And of course, Rory McIlroy, Tiger Woods have also done it in the last 25 years ago. And we're back now with Rex Hoggard, Ryan Lavner, continuing our discussion about this. Rex, who do you think leaves feeling particularly positive this week? Is it a Bob McIntyre? And what about a guy like, say, a John Rahm? Played his way in. He was sort of on the fringes of the mix late on Sunday, but that was more so of sort of a backdoor top 10 finish for him. Does a guy like him or Scottie Scheffler, do they leave disappointed thinking that a few strokes here or there, this was theirs?
Well, I think JJ Spaun leaves with a lot of positivity. Yeah. I think that's pretty obvious when you look at it. But I think Scottie Scheffler probably worked his way into position where he left here looking ahead to what's next, the Travelers Championship, a signature event next week, obviously the Open Championship next month. These are all things he's going to focus on. But I think if anybody is going to take momentum from this, it's going to be someone like an Adam Scott. And I'm sure the disappointment is going to take a little while to get over. But we spent a lot of time talking about it on the podcast, the idea that this would be the exclamation point on what I would argue right now is a Hall of Fame career. I think he felt the pressure probably more so than anyone because of what this would mean to his legacy. It's one thing to be a one-time major champion. It's a whole different category to have done it twice, especially at that stage in your life. And he's been there so many times. I think this would have meant so much to him. However, he always seems to start playing his best golf this time of year. I remember last year at the Scottish Open, something just clicked. So I expect him to finish up the summer very strong.
I think a player like Victor Hovland could also take a lot of confidence. This is a player who sort of, even in victory at the Valspar Championship, was expressing how uncomfortable he was with his golf swing in Oakmont Country Club. The toughest golf course in America was standing up on the tee and not even guiding it. He had confidence, at least for a couple rounds, that he knew where the ball was going. His iron play has once again reached an elite level. To be able to do what he did on this golf course, still not feeling 100%, he even admitted that, look, I've probably been a little bit too hard on myself. I need to give myself a little bit more grace. I think this was a great learning opportunity for him to know that he didn't have his best stuff, yet he still had an opportunity to win a major championship.
Speaking of being granted grace, Rory McIlroy seems to be in a pretty strange spot a couple months after completing the career Grand Slam, taking the singular journey that none of us could even potentially possibly understand what he's been going through. Should he be allowed a little grace to kind of figure himself out? I think he's my favorite golfer to talk to, post-round, pre-round, on the driving range, because he's so introspective and thoughtful. Those are not words I would use to describe him of late.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's certainly puzzling. It's disappointing because, to your point, like, we want to hear from Rory. I think particularly at this time in his life, how is he navigating this new normal as being sort of a legend of the game, being immortal? What's his motivation? Like, these are all pretty weighty questions that he would have the answer to, or at least can sort of talk about publicly. But it's also understandable what he is going through and why he's doing it. He's just sort of over it at this point. The whole performative aspect of competing inside the ropes and then talking about what could be a pretty mundane, ordinary round of golf. It sounds, at least according to Rory, he talked both Saturday and Sunday, so the media boycott is seemingly over. But I think he's sort of voicing that he's not, you know, still miffed about the driver issue necessarily. It's nothing personal. It's just he wants a little bit of space, and he wants to sort of figure this out on his own.
And I think this gives perspective. The idea that Tiger Woods completed the career Grand Slam at such a young age and then did it again and kept doing it. You get an idea of how difficult it is. I keep going back to Rory's quote earlier in the week about on Wednesday when he spoke with the media about the idea you dream about standing on that green and putting that jacket on, about winning the career Grand Slam. That's what you always envision. You never think about what comes next. And what has come next has clearly been difficult. And it's easy to empathize. I can't imagine what it's like to reach your career goals because I'm never going to get there. I know that for a fact. But you can imagine when you get his words, not mine, to Everest, you got to figure out how to get back down. And I think right now that's where he's at.
Wyndham Clark left his mark on Oakmont. Unfortunately, he did it in the clubhouse, in the locker room, with a little bit of damage after a frustrating week for him. What did you make of that?
I've seen worse, and I'm sure we'll continue to see him in the U.S. Open. I mean, this is probably what's going to happen. Players getting pushed to the breaking point. I think as it relates to Wyndham Clark in particular, it's a little bit of a troubling pattern. This is a player who's been pretty open about some of the mental struggles that he's had between the ropes. He's working so hard with his sports psychologist, Julie Elion, to sort of be easier on himself. But we saw at the PGA Championship with the club throw, ended up smashing one of the markers behind the tee at Quail Hollow. We saw him with a pretty blatant F-bomb inside the ropes as well, and then reportedly the locker damage. It's clear that he needs to take a little bit of a timeout here, reassess, and try to figure out where he goes from here.
Seems to be two sides to the story. They're athletes. Let them be. The other side is, hey, you're a guest at this club and a professional. Where do you think that line sits?
I can only imagine how much that's going to cost him to fix that damage. And I did think it was intriguing on social media, of all people, Ian Poulter jumped in, because here's a guy who admitted on a social media post that, I've done this a couple times. Like, look, sometimes you just get worked up. Sometimes you get angry. If any golf course is going to lead you to destroy public property, I guess it's going to be this one. I certainly understand where he's coming from. It's bad form, though. You're a guest here. Probably shouldn't have done it.
So what are we next looking forward to? You know, the kind of question I think that's grading under Rory McIlroy is, what do you got next? Well, what we have next, the Open Championship at Portrush. We're three majors into the season. But pretty diverse storylines when you think about it.
Someone asked me this morning, would Scotty be the favorite? And of course he is. I guess if I could sit here all day long,
Some people think he's still the favorite for the U.S. Open sitting right
good
here.
Good point. Yeah, I mean, I think everybody was just waiting on Sunday for him to make that move. However, if you look at the Open Championship, you look at that golf course, there's so many variables that come in. That's why it's my most enjoyable event of the year, because you really can't handicap it, because you have no idea what the weather's going to be like. It seems like they play golf for 24 hours each day. And I think I would go in thinking Scotty's the favorite, but imagine all the different possibilities.
I wanted to get into the Ryder Cup so badly. There's still time. There's a lot of distance between now and September. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Great week all week long. Appreciate it.
Appreciate
Rex it, guys. And Lav. And if you need more Rex and Lav in your life, yeah, you can have it right now. In the market for a podcast, please check out the Golf Channel podcast. Our guys Rex and Lav filling it up. And if you miss any of Golf Today, you can find our best interviews on the Golf Today podcast. And be sure to subscribe to the Golf Channel YouTube page as well. Oh, so many wonderful images. What will you take away from the 125th U.S. Open? Right hand from J.J. Spahn. Yeah, the rain. It's part of the story as well. So many contenders, so much mayhem. At the end of the day, it was JJ and the fans. We're back on Golf Today, and we're thinking about some of the roster champions here at Oakmont. Ben Hogan won his fourth and final U.S. Open here in 1953. Six-shot triumph over his great rival, Sam Snead. A wire-to-wire victory for the Hawk. About Jack Nicklaus. Before he was the Golden Bear, he was an upstart from Ohio State, somehow, some way, staring down Arnold Palmer in his own backyard. Went to a playoff. Jack won the first of a record 18 major championships, out 71 to Arnie's 74. How about Johnny Miller? What a treat it was to see him on the grounds of Oakmont this week, and what a treat it was to see him back in 1973. Shot that 63 in the final round, firing at pins, making up that six-shot deficit to overcome John Schlee, Jerry Hurd, Arnold Palmer, and Julius Burrows. 10 years later, Larry Nelson, with the help of that 62-foot birdie putt on the 16th hole that helped him take down the defending champ Tom Watson by one shot. When the putt dropped, Nelson took a little jog across the green and into the history books, eventually into the World Golf Hall of Fame. Now J.J. Spahn has added his name to the list of major champs at this historic venue. Incredible finish, going birdie-birdie. Be the only man under par this week. And someone who saw it all, Taylor Zarzur, Sirius XM, PGA Tour Radio. Great to see you, buddy, Monday. Yeah. Just, you've covered so many big-time events. Where does this finish, just as a sports fan, rank in your mind?
Well, certainly the finish was spectacular when you have a 64-foot, 5-inch putt to win. I mean, how rare is that to see a putt of that length? You just mentioned Larry Nelson on the 16th green over 40 years ago. To do it on the 18th green, I can't think in recent memory of a putt that long that's that meaningful. You think of Marco Mira and the Masters in 1998 with a putt that was about half that long to win on the final hole. Obviously, all he had to do was two-putt. To make a putt like that is something that we will remember forever. But I think the reason it's memorable, Damon, isn't just because of J.J. Spahn and who made the putt. I think it's memorable because of Oakmont. And Oakmont, I feel like, won this week. I think that all the members that are right inside right now feel like they won this week. They want to have the toughest test in all of golf. The USGA clearly has an identity. It is the toughest championship, and that's exactly what it was. Who knew that a drenched Oakmont would be harder than a dry Oakmont was the first couple of days? And by the way, do you live here now? I mean, you've been on this porch for a couple of weeks now.
It really feels as though I am actually a resident of Pennsylvania, but the taxes are probably better than New York at this point. Are you a fan of those old-style U.S. Opens? Because we've had some variety the last couple of years between, say, Pinehurst number 2, South Course at LACC. Very different tests than what we had here. This kind of felt like an old-school meat grinder kind of U.S. Open. Is that your style of golf that you want to see?
Once a year, absolutely, because I think it separates itself from all the other events. I don't want to see it this week at the Travelers. Yeah. I'd like to see them make birdies again this week. But, no, I think once a year it's great to have that. And, yeah, I think that when you have a rota, just like the Open has a rota over in Scotland and in Northern Ireland and in England, to have a rota of courses this year, last year with Pinehurst, this year with Oakmont, next year with Shinnecock, the year after that with Pebble, all four of those places feel like the U.S. Open. So, yes, to answer your question, I do like it a lot. But if we did it more than once a year and we saw the guys struggle like this, I don't know that the fans would be that turned on to it.
Nicer than me. I want to see these guys struggle every year.
Well, we had the rain to match Northern Ireland, England, and Scotland this week. And to that point, things yesterday, it seemed like at one point they were going to be a little over the edge. It was getting a little goofy. We saw Burns and Scotty double the 11th. We saw Burns in 15 and not getting relief from casual water. But this is the national championship. It is a U.S. Open. It's supposed to be difficult. Your brain is supposed to be scrambled. Are you okay with the decision-making on Sunday?
Yes, I am, but it was right on the line, and I think the USGA had a very hard decision to make yesterday in terms of trying to finish this event on a Sunday. Right. You do not want to finish this on a Monday if you can prevent it, and they were right on the line yesterday and almost lost the golf course, but I give them exceptional credit, especially during that delay, to get the golf course playable. I would say it certainly looked like Sam Burns should have gotten relief there in that situation, and Brad Faxon said that in the moment. And I think he spoke for almost everyone watching. Having said that, I don't think Sam Burns would have won the U.S. Open if he got relief from that casual water. And it's because J.J. Spahn, in those difficult conditions, went out and won the tournament. Had Robert McIntyre or J.J. Spahn not gone out there and performed the way they did, then I think we could be sitting here today saying, well, I just don't know that it was they were fair conditions. But they were. There were guys that went out and made birdies and won the tournament, and that's what J.J. did.
I'm sure if we got the USGA rules officials out here, they would explain why two separate officials decided Sam Burns wasn't entitled to that relief. How impressive was it how he actually handled that in the aftermath? Because a lot of guys would have gotten up there after making a double bogey in those circumstances and been a lot less gracious than Sam Burns was.
It's a good point, Eamon, and you're right. A lot of guys that you and I know well, I don't think would have handled that nearly as well. Given what happened there. And maybe our definition of casual water is different from what the official's definition was in that situation yesterday. But it certainly looked to me like he should have gotten relief. But the fact that he seemed to turn the other cheek, as you're saying, and move on says a lot about Sam. And I think that Sam won over a lot of people this week. I wouldn't be surprised if Sam won over Keegan Bradley this week. You're looking for Americans to fill out a roster. J.J. Spahn looks like one you could use. Sam Burns looks like another, and I would add Ben Griffin to that list, too.
To your point, let's talk a little Ryder Cup, because the theme of the early part of this season was look at the Europeans, look at Rory and Thomas Dietrich and Sepp Straka, and the Americans seemed a little bit lost, maybe some of the traditional guys, the names that we're used to seeing not playing that well, but then you have the emergence of a J.J. Spahn, Ben Griffin, Andrew Novak, et cetera. Do you think that with Scotty playing as he is, that maybe things will be a little more even going into September, though there's still lots of time between now and then?
Well, I think that's why Luke Donald, the European Ryder Cup captain, and Paul McGinley, who is on the set from Live From, want the Ryder Cup to be played right now. I think the last couple of months, they've looked at the form their players have had and said, I don't know how much longer this is going to last. The American team is going to arrive at some point. And yeah, it does feel like, Damon, the Americans are getting a little bit of momentum. I still think the European team is deeper than the American team as we sit here right now today. And even though that European featured group we had this week was shockingly bad, with Justin Rose and Shane Lowry missing the cut by a mile and Rory just barely making the cut, there were other Europeans that did perform well and had a chance to win the event, led by Bobby Mack. But to your point, I think the American team, you give them more time over the summer months, we're going to see a team that all of a sudden settles itself by the time we get to Bethpage Black.
It's hard to say anyone would leave here disappointed, Taylor, because it's not as though there were a ton of birdies out there. It wasn't a great scoring opportunity, and everyone is just trying to get to the clubhouse. But having said that, who do you think leaves Oakmont thinking that that one should have been mine?
Adam Scott and Sam Burns, but first I would say Adam Scott, because through about 11, 12 holes, even after the restart, you could see a path for Adam Scott to win the U.S. Open, and then it all completely fell apart in those last four or five holes. He's 44 years old. He's about to be 45. He's an extraordinary...
Would there have been a better winner yesterday?
No. I mean, not for the game and just the way that he's been celebrated, the person he is. Yeah, I think a lot of people that know Adam, have been around him forever, were cheering for him. I think a lot of people here were cheering for him as well. And you have to wonder. It's the same thing as Justin Rose, who happens to be the same age. Justin Rose, I know, was thrilled for Rory McIlroy when he won the Masters because they're great friends, but he also was gutted because he's thinking, how many more chances am I going to have? And I have to think Adam Scott is thinking that same thing. Sam Burns has to be disappointed because it was his tournament through the first 65, 66 holes or so, but Sam Burns is in his late 20s. You have to think that Sam's going to have more opportunities if he keeps playing like this. Is Adam Scott?
Taylor, you're the best. Great listening to you all week. Love your perspective as always. We did this last year at Pinehurst, and great to do it again at Oakmont. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Damon. How come he never says that?
I'm just a skosh nicer, just a skosh. But I still love Damon as well.
In 1933, a trucker drove up with a load of potatoes, was refused at the produce terminal right across the street, and sliced up the potatoes. The trucker was like, you know what, just throw that on my sandwich, I gotta go. That was the birthplace of the Permane sandwich right there.
Making me hungry. As we continue here in golf today, some more of the memorable images from Sunday's finish, the 125th United States Open. JJ Spong claiming his first career major title in pretty dramatic fashion over those last couple of holes. And that's first U.S. Open coming in two or fewer starts in the National Open. Well, that's a pretty small list. Webb Simpson, Ernie Els here at Oakmont back in 1994, Jerry Pate, Tony Jacklin, and the Sarge, Orville Moody, back in 1969. And Todd Lewis joins us now. Todd's been interviewing major champions in the immediate aftermath of a victory for 15 years, which I'm guessing never gets old. Last night, it's an interesting story here. J.J. Spong, not the biggest star in the field, but what a story of perseverance for this guy.
Yeah, I mean, and that you could go back to his junior days when he came out of Southern California. Wasn't the biggest, wasn't the strongest in this day of this modern prototype being 6'3 and living in the gym. He's, you know, and I say this affectionately, JJ, kind of a dad bod god, you know, because I'm one too. But, you know, just like Dory said in Finding Nemo, he just kept swimming and found his way to San Diego State, found his way out here on the PGA Tour. And perseverance, I think that's a big thing for him this year, but I think also education and the fact he put himself in moments, that he, big moments, like at the Players with Rory. And although he didn't get the job done, he never seemed rattled. It seemed like he absorbed what he needs to do to cross the threshold in big moments, and he took advantage yesterday.
Could have been a Bob May moment. We see him at the Players, and maybe he disappears. Rocco Mediate, maybe the high point was a runner-up finish to Tiger in 08. So it could have been that story for JJ. Instead, he has this huge moment here. Why?
I think he has tremendous heart. I'm talking to the people around him the most. I think he is, I think he just has a lot of belief that, you know, maybe needed a little fine tuning this year. But when you put yourself in those moments, not only at the Players, but also at the Sony, also at the Cognizant this year, he had chances to win, but when you put yourself in those moments consistently, the belief is still there, and you feel like you're just that close from going from good to great. And I think his heart, his determination that got him to the PGA Tour carried him over the line to win this championship.
Does he feel like a bit of a throwback, Todd, to when, do you remember when there used to be something that was called a U.S. Open player? It was the Lee Johnsons, the Payne Stewarts, the Scott Simpsons of the world, who didn't necessarily have a huge weapon. But when they were in the moment, they could summon a kind of clarity under the chaos. that other players couldn't. And that seems to be what J.J. Spawn did yesterday.
How many times have we turned on the TV and watching or been out here watching these guys play and we see club throws and we kick the dirt? Did we see that from J.J. this week? Oh. Not once.
And this, from quite a lot of you know,
kicking lockers or whatever you want to call he always looked, whether he felt it or not, he looked calm. He looked in control. And obviously, you have to have great emotional control to be successful in anything, I think. And that's a real asset for J.J., and it showed.
What should we know about the makeup of his team? Adam Schreiber, Josh Gregory, too. Kind of iconoclasts, I would probably call them. They kind of zig while others zag. What do we know about the guys kind of behind the guy?
Well, first off, they enjoy working with J.J. for many reasons. He's a quality player, but a quality person as well. They're different. they're unique. Interestingly, Josh Gregory became his short game coach just this week. Started working with J.J. on how to apply a different technique out of the rough to kind of hit more up on the ball instead of down, and that really... was a positive for him this week. Interestingly, Josh Gregory was the 2012 Palmer Cup captain. He wanted to put J.J. on the team, but he was working with his other assistants, and they decided to leave him off. But they've remained friends for a long, long time. And as for Adam, you know, he's a unique spirit. I found it interesting that they worked on his swing with foot pads and how he uses the ground. Because that is a strength of J.J. J.J. was an elite junior skateboarder. I mean, there were thoughts of him possibly becoming a professional skateboarder as he moved his way into adulthood, but he found out, you know, not much chance of getting a compound fracture hitting a six iron compared to skateboarding, so he chose the right sport.
You could have actually gotten a compound fracture this week hitting a six iron out of the rough here. And normally when we see scoring this high and conditions as difficult as they were for 4 days, what normally comes after that is, surely as the sun rises in the east, is player complaints. Didn't hear any of that this week. Are you surprised by that?
No, I don't think so. I think that the players understand that, first off, the U.S. Open is probably the toughest championship to win from a course perspective, that it's going to be set up the hardest. But especially here at Oakmont, I think they had a spirit of acceptance, all the players that were in the field, that this is going to be brutal. It's going to test every club in your bag, and it's going to test your emotions, as we talked about earlier. So I think that they just accepted it and came here and tried to beat the course, which is just about impossible.
Well, speaking of spirit, the thought was Rory McIlroy would have a spirit of lightness following his completion of the career Grand Slam, winning the Masters in April. It's been anything but light for the five-time major champ since he donned a green jacket. What do you see going on with Rory, and what's next for him?
That's a tough question to answer. I think it's easy for us to understand that the person that we see on the golf course, the guy that entertains us, that's who he is all the time. I mean, you know, these guys have challenges just like all of us. You know, ups and downs, personal life, professional life. So it can be challenging at times to compartmentalize all of that. So, you know, Rory may be just going through a little bit of a valley in his life right now, and he'll figure things out. But everything is temporary with him, I think. I think this is just a little blip on the radar. And Rory's a genuine person. We all know that. And we're going to see that moving forward.
It's also got to be pretty interesting to achieve your lifetime ambition. And the first series of questions you get are, well, what's next? Yeah. What have you got for us after that? Bob McIntyre finished second yesterday. He's got to leave here with a great sense of positivity. And he also showed a lot of class watching that putt go in and applauding at the time. A couple of his potential Ryder Cup teammates, Victor Hovland, Tyrrell Hatton, maybe a little bit more bruised. How do you think they are going to assess their weeks?
I don't think Victor Hovland is as bruised as you think. I mean, he didn't have it.
Because he didn't expect to be. Yeah. He's in his swing rabbit hole. You don't
think he expected to be there?
Well, I think he's moving in a positive direction. Talking to him all week, he and Grant Waite, they feel like they are getting to the Victor Hovland, not of 2023 when he won the FedEx Cup, but of 2019, 2020. That's when he felt like he was swinging his best. He may have been a better player in 23, but I think they are moving mechanically towards that direction. So I think he leaves here saying, okay, we're trending. As for Tyrrell Hatton, Tyrrell's been playing pretty well. I mean, he's still very much going to be on that Ryder Cup team for Europe. Put himself in this position. I don't think either one of them are leaving saying, gosh, man, I'm not great right now. I think that they're saying it's going the right way.
How about the final group? Sam Burns, Adam Scott. You've spoken to both of them a lot through the years. Your big takeaway from their Sunday and what they might be feeling on this Monday.
Adam Scott is a beautiful statesman for golf. He's regal. He's great for the game. He's involved in the PGA Tour policy board. He was in the White House, in the Oval Office with Donald Trump and the representatives from PIF. So he's got a lot going on. It would have been I think he's probably disappointed. That's my guess, that he had a chance here to put another major championship on his resume that I think is a resume that belongs in the World Golf Hall of Fame. He may not think that, but I do. So I think he's probably a little dejected. Sam Burns, going back to the reference of Tyrrell Hatton and going back to Victor Hovland, is trending. He's finally moving in a positive direction again because he went through a valley where he missed three straight cuts this year. It would have been cool to see Adam hold that trophy again, a major championship trophy rather again, but he's probably disappointed.
Yeah, one more shot before the year is up. T. Lou, always great to visit with you. Great job this week, and thank you
too,
for joining us.
Good to hang with you.
So here's what JJ's peers had to say about his triumph.
Nice, hold it.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Unbelievable. What a putt to win. That's incredible.
What do you think he's feeling right now?
In shock, I would guess. Unbelievable. Fair play.
Look, I just gave him some guidance. He needed some help. We've been friends forever. I've helped him a few times. Obviously, we did a lot more work this week on understanding what he needs to do around the greens. But he is caddy Mark and Adam Schreiber. That's the glue, man. They've built this. And JJ has been a kind of an overachiever his whole life. And to me, to be a small part of it and help him this week is truly special. Because there's not really a better dude on tour. He's an overachiever, he's a grinder, and he just needs instructions and guidance. But this should validate to him, most importantly, that he's one of the best players in the world.
We did a lot of good work in the offseason tapping into his skater feet. He's a skateboarder as a kid, and we used that to kind of build his swing. And his footwork's, I think, spectacular.
You gotta explain that. How do you put skateboard into golf?
We use force plates, you know, and we just optimize the efficiency of using his skater legs, you know what I mean? And I tell him his feet are a superpower.
Personally, how impactful is it for you to see your student, your friend, go out here and win a major championship?
Yeah, it's like everybody, you know how it is out here. We all sacrifice so much, right, to be here and to see it come to fruition. I mean, that's why we do it, and it's for these moments, you know?
It's hard to put it into words. It's magic. When I saw him walking towards me with that trophy, I just fell apart. If my eyes are red and I look like, bye, baby. I broke. I cried immensely. I'm a very emotional person. All that emotion just came out. It was just a powerful feeling.
What were you processing with those emotions?
Love, hard work. It's been a journey. I mean, it's been a journey of probably 30 years. He's 34, but he's been golfing since he's 3-4 years old. It's just been hard work, and it's been ups and downs. There's a lot of downs in golf. People don't realize how many downs there are, and it's all of that, those ups and downs and the hard work that he's put in. He's put in so much time, and I'm just so proud of him for breaking through this time.
JJ Spaun finds himself on a pretty elite list of players who've won their first major title in their ninth major start. Arnold Palmer, Gary Player, Tom Watson, Jordan Spieth. That is great company to be in. And speaking of great company, we are pleased to be joined by somebody who knows a little something about making a long putt to win a title, albeit in Canada, not in the United States. Brandel Chambly. Brandel, that famous Sandy Tatum line about identifying the world's best players, not embarrassing them, was the best player this week identified at Oakmont in your mind?
I think so. I mean, I think that should be a prologue for every U.S. Open, but I think the Rudyard Kipling if poem should more likely be, if you can keep your wits about you and all around you, those are losing theirs. Because if you go back to that back nine yesterday and you just go through the players that were in the mix, Sam Burns, Adam Scott, Tyrrell Hatton, Carlos Ortiz, and you just go back to the moment where it slipped away from them, you know? The most difficult golf course, under the most difficult conditions, with the most severe pressure that any of these players face in any major championship. And I asked J.J. Spaun last night on the set, was it a technical change or was it a mental reset after being five over through six holes and after the delay? He said 100% mental. He came out and he said, look, just stay in there, hang in there, keep hitting shots, keep grinding it out, and give luck a chance, so to speak. So, yeah, I would say so. Yeah, the best player, you know, I asked a number of players, as you probably did, and a number of people in the media Sunday morning, who do you think is going to win? Without hesitation, every single one of them said J.J. Spaun. But if I would have said to them, okay, J.J. Spaun's going to go out and hit half the fairways, he's going to miss six greens, and he will not get a single one of them up and down, you still think he's going to win? And I think that describes the sort of cataclysmic chaos that we all saw yesterday.
Such a big boy golf course, 07, Angel, 2016, Dustin Johnson. Is there any aspect about his game that surprised you that it held up so well? 1 week with Josh Gregory working on release patterns in the rough. It just seemed to come out of nowhere, his player's finish notwithstanding.
Look, I'll say this. So I always say the incremental becomes exponential. It's like compound interest. So let's just take a little tour back real quick. 2020, he was 145th in strokes gained approach. 2021, he was 127. 2022, he was 84th. 2023, he was 51. 2024, he was 17. This year, he's 5th in strokes gained approach. Now, that is 5-6 solid years of work, incrementally better, then becomes exponentially better. Now, with that comes belief. And since we're in Pittsburgh, I'll give you a Pittsburgh analogy. It's like the Allegheny and the Monongahela River coming together to form the Ohio. That's execution, or that's hard work and belief coming together to give you flow. And then you begin to put it all together, and you get this finished product, the Mississippi River, which is where the Ohio flows into. And this is exactly what it was. It was a great golf swing, great work ethic. It was great execution. But really, it was the belief, and that's what he talked about last night. He began to believe that he could compete with the best players in the world. And really, that's what the U.S. Open is all about. The back nine at the U.S. Open should test everything. It should be, it's different than the Masters. The Masters is about how's somebody going to recover. So if you think about Rory on 15, hitting that shot to the left. Now, that would have been thick rough here. He's likely going to make bogey. But there it was like managing risk and reward. That's what's exciting about the Masters. This is different. This is about if you miss a shot and you know it's going to cost you, what's it going to cost you? So can you execute? This was about execution, which is about clarity of mind, and which is about hard work. All that came together on the back nine yesterday in J.J. Spaun.
This was very much an old-school U.S. Open on an old-school U.S. Open golf course. You kind of know what you're going to get at Oakmont. But does he remind you of an era when there used to be a thing we would refer to as a U.S. Open player, a Hale Irwin, a Lee Johnson, a Scott Simpson, a Payne Stewart, guys who didn't necessarily have a huge weapon in their arsenal, but the mind was a heck of a weapon when it counted?
Yeah, it's a great point. I said last night this was like going to an antique car show. You're like, wow, I didn't know they made them like that anymore. You know, that's cool. Look at that. And that's what J.J. Spaun, I would throw in Lee Trevino. Yeah. You know, you think about what a U.S. Open was. It was so demanding that it forced players to go and work on control, yes, power, yes, but every other aspect of the game. Now everybody goes out and they're just trying to increase their ball speed because the game disproportionately rewards ball speed and doesn't recognize enough control. Control should matter. That's why this was a very important event. This is a throwback, but it's also saying the game's out of whack right now. It's inside out. I promise you, if they had more events like this, if they had more major championships like this, if the U.S. Open were consistently like this, the players that make sacrifices for power would make sacrifices for control, and we would all be treated to the highest echelon of this game by so many players, and not just a few, and not just one time a year.
Continue your car analogy. The cars were wet yesterday. It was raining.
See, that's a professional segue. You can teach him a thing or two about that.
We're working on him. You okay with what you saw, the doubles from Sam and Adam Scott on 11 and, of course, 15 fairway when Sam Burns twice denied a drop?
Yeah, I can't say enough about the way Sam Burns handled that situation. Yeah. That had been very difficult to do. I can't say enough about the way Adam Scott spoke about it afterwards when saying it was borderline unplayable. It looked like that. It looked like one of those situations where it was borderline unplayable. But everybody, agreed to go play. Nobody really raised their hand and said, that's it, I'm done, I'm not playing, I can't hit this here. And I saw the video posted with Sam Burns. I saw, I think it was Kyle Porter who went out as we look at the shot right now. You know, Kyle Porter, I think, posted the video where he was stepping. And if indeed that is the exact spot where Sam Burns was hitting a golf shot from, you'd have thought he'd be more persistent, but he wasn't. He was like, what do you think? What do you think? And he accepted it. So, okay, yes, borderline unplayable perhaps, but you have to be able to make adjustments. And I always talk about the prevalence of pickers winning major championships. So when the water, when it gets like that, you got to be able to pick it. Okay, so there are a lot of great aspects of Sam Burns' game. And we saw another side to him, and maybe he got the belief this week and he'll go on and win another a major somewhere down the road. But the worst aspect of his game is iron play. And it came to fruition. You know, the iron that he hit at 11 yesterday out of the divot, the third shot he hit into 12, and then the second shot at 15. You got to be able to pick it. When it gets that way, you got to be able to pick it. And so, look, those were miscues. And certainly the conditions played into it. You know, you saw Adam Scott on 12, had 130 yards in, missed the number by 25 yards. These guys don't miss a number by 25 yards. That does not happen. So probably a flyer there. So, yeah, the conditions were unplayable, but they were borderline unplayable, but they were borderline unplayable for everybody.
Sam Burns, obviously, he burnished his reputation with the way he handled that. He wasn't carping about it after the fact or blaming somebody else. He had a good week reputationally. Wyndham Clark, maybe not so much.
Yeah, not so much for sure. You know, seeing those pictures, you know, just scratches your head. You know, just the lack of discipline, the lack of self-awareness, the lack of respect for the membership here. I mean, that's their locker room. You're a guest. You know, imagine if a guest comes to your house. You might do this. You wouldn't do this. But, I don't like the meal and throw the plate away. You know, I made double bogey today and start throwing dishes. I always joke around that social media is like a party at my house. You can come in, you can disagree, but the minute you start breaking dishes, you got to go. And he's breaking dishes. So, you know, I hope he's reprimanded for sure. I mean, you cannot allow that. You can't have that kind of behavior. But on the whole yesterday, I just got to applaud Robert McIntyre. Yeah. You know, he's sitting there waiting. He's got a chance. It's three-puttable for sure, 100%. Players are more likely to three-putt from 32 feet than they are to make it, okay? He's 64 feet, exactly double 32 feet. Far more likely to three-putt that than to make it. I mean, crazy numbers. He had to think, I got a chance. I could win this U.S. Open. The putt goes in. Now, come on. That's great. And then it goes to Tyrrell Hatton, who's watching it, and he said, it's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, it was the highest example it was all class. Mm-hmm. It was the highest example of sportsmanship. And if I could I just take a moment here to real quickly talk about another subject that we were all talking about last week, Rory McIlroy? I just want to say real quickly, and, you know, I would consider Rory the best friend of golf in the last 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years. He's been the best friend of the game, okay? And I think most everybody in the game who doesn't even have a bias would readily admit that. And if he were your best friend, if you had a best friend and he started or she started acting indifferently or a little odd for a week or two, you don't burn the bridge. What you do is say, hey, man, is everything okay? And I'm here if you need me. Whatever it is, you know, I'm here, but I hope you sort it out and hang in there. That's what you would do. He's too important to the game for golf to burn a bridge with this guy because none of us really know everything that's going on. And I'm no Rory apologist. I hardly even know Rory. I know what I observe. I know what I see. I know how he plays. But I also know how important he is to the game. He's our best friend. And so I think everybody just, you know, he needs a little grace at the moment for whatever he's going through.
Where do you see him bouncing back going forward? I mean, what he's done is unprecedented. To me, it's Tiger Slam 01, where after he completed the slam, didn't see much of him at Southern Hills, didn't see much of him in that U.S. Open or at Lytham in 01 or in Atlanta at the PGA, did not play his best. Rory's path has been so singular. He was convulsing on that 72nd green at the Masters. Shouldn't he be allowed extended grace? Is as selfish as we all are and want to hear from him, that we love talking to him, we love picking his brain, we love his insight.
Isn't that an interesting question, though, that Tiger racked up all of these accomplishments, but you never got the sense that Tiger took the time to enjoy them? because he moved on to the next. And to me, that's a question. Now, Rory McIlroy's talked about the desire to have more fun in life, and I don't know if he's had enough time to actually enjoy what he accomplished.
I think those are good points. I think one of the things that he wanted to do, you know, look, I mean, I have friends that are really good friends of his, and to enjoy life a little bit. You know, Tiger was so singularly possessed at climbing another mountain, and climbing mountains that nobody could find or even point to. And I look, we all benefited from it, okay? But it probably came at a cost to him. And, you know, if you care about these people, it's like balance in life is important. And, you know, maybe Rory was getting too close to the flame and needs to back away and have a little bit of fun. But, you know, his interview yesterday morning with Kira K. Dixon was outstanding. Yeah. It was brilliant. It was wonderful. And you know, he talked afterwards about, okay, the next mountain is an open championship in Ireland. At Poor Rush. So it sounds to me like he's got another mountain. And, you know, he shot 67 yesterday. He drove the ball better. And, you know, this is a very small sample size of him struggling in the game of golf. So it was good to see him go out yesterday and put a great number on the board.
Randall, we know you usually work nights. We appreciate you waking up early for us to...
Well, I'm told it was just you. So I was like, you bet, I'll go work with David. I didn't know he was coming. I would have said, sorry, I got better things to do.
We appreciate it, my friend. We'll see you soon. There he is.
Show. That's hard for me to say anything nice to you.
There he is, folks. Randall Shambly. You know, we're going to continue this conversation on Rory, a little deep dive into what is next following a Grand Slam. Maybe it is Port Rush. Maybe it is a Ryder Cup. Maybe it is 2026. More on Rory.
Yesterday was six. Majors are a row. Rounds kind of stepped away. Is that then part and parcel to the frustration on the golf course? What would you attribute?
No, not really. It's more a frustration with you guys, but...
Yeah, Ooh.
I'm just, I don't know. I mean, I've been totally available for the last few years. And I'm not saying maybe not you guys, but maybe more just
the whole thing.
The whole
driver thing.
Yeah, I mean, that was a part of it. That was a part of it. But it's not as if, like, at Augusta, I skipped you guys on Thursday. So, it's not as if it's not out of the ordinary. I've done it before. I'm just doing it a little more often.
Is it part of the, you kind of carry the tour or awards for about 3 or 4 years now. You feel like you've earned a break?
I feel like I've earned the right to do whatever I want to do. Yeah.
You have, in relation to that, kind of almost addressed fact that the tour does not require that kind of fight. It's almost like you're daring them to do so in some way. Is that, you know, in terms of a requirement?
No, I'm not daring them to do anything. I hope they don't change it, because it was, you know, it's a nice luxury to have. But I'm just pointing out the fact that we have the ability to do it.
What do you look for tomorrow?
You know, hopefully a round in under 4.5 hours and get out of here.
Yeah, and after some nice play today, are you hoping a very special tournament like this can reignite your best form to impress at home?
Yeah, you know, I think, look, if I can't get motivated to get up for an Open Championship at home, then I don't know what can motivate me. So, you know, as I said, I just need to get myself in the right frame of mind. I probably haven't been there the last few weeks. But, you know, as I said, getting home and you know, having a couple of weeks off before that, you know, hopefully feeling refreshed and rejuvenated, will get me in the right place again.
You know how the game ebbs and flows right through your career. I remember 2013 was a year when you had to get something back when you went to new equipment. But now you've got a scenario whereby you've got Port Rush coming up, which is a wonderful target to kind of look at back home in Northern Ireland. Is that the type of thing that might just fire the jets?
I think so. Look, I climbed my Everest in April, and I think after you do something like that, you got to make your way back down, and you got to look for another mountain to climb. And you know, an Open up Port Rush is certainly one of those.
So, Damon, what it feels like is you're looking at a couple of different Rory McIlroys there. If you'd read the coverage of Rory versus the media over the last couple of weeks, you would have thought he was in the witness protection program, but he did actually speak in the pre-tournament press conference in Canada last week. He spoke earlier this week He spoke after two rounds here. He's going to speak in a couple of days at the Travelers Championship as well. What I think part of the context is here of this Rory McIlroy mindset is he has not taken the time to actually process what was the achieving of a lifetime dream here. I mean, if you go back and look, 1997 and again 2019, when Tiger Woods had probably the two most seismic victories of his career, the first Masters and the last, Tiger wasn't seen for 5 weeks in either case. Rory McIlroy had 10 days after the Masters before showing up at the Zurich Classic to play with Shane Lowry. And in the interim, he'd been in London and Northern Ireland to visit family as well. So I don't actually think he's taken the time to process it. And then he comes back to a series of questions. And every question is, OK, what are you going to do next? Yeah. What does the next chapter look like? And he doesn't necessarily have that chapter. That's not to say he's not going to have that chapter. But he actually, I don't think, has taken the time to process yet. Because for the last 10 years, there has been one dream.
Well, I'll tell you what, he has given us and gifted us so many incredible storylines. The lack of a major for a decade plus was a storyline that we would harp on and that he would be asked about. His play has been a gift. Post-Tiger Woods, he's been the most compelling watch in the game. His availability has been a gift. His openness, his position in the world of golf. But I think at the end of the day, April and with what happened on that green and in the aftermath, he couldn't have known how exhausting it would be. And I think he's just over it. And listen, selfishly, we want to hear from him because he's thoughtful, because he takes a breath and exhales and thinks about his answer before just throwing out something rote. I'm appreciative of it, but also just as a human being, I can't even think I know what he's going through on the course, off the course, all of it. And with the amount of golf that he's being asked to play, and these guys are asked to play, it's a busy schedule from players to majors to signature events. And there's a microphone in his face, much like Tiger, after nearly every round of golf.
Yeah, the demands on his time and the requests for his time from the media probably far outnumber any of his colleagues. And it has raised an interesting question. We saw it with Colin Morikawa earlier this year as well, this idea of, do players owe the media anything? And there are plenty of folks in the media who believe they do. It's nonsense. They do not owe the media anything. The question is, do they owe the consumers of their product something? And that's a problem, I suppose, for the PGA Tour, and less so for the entities that run the major championships. They need to decide in men's professional golf if they are in the we business or the me business. Are they still individual contractors and players who can do whatever they want? Or are they owners, as they believe themselves to be with this equity program at the PGA Tour, are they owners of the game, in which case they do have a responsibility to market and sell their own product? And I get the frustrations that these guys have out there. And I talked to Rory McIlroy on the range yesterday, and he said there is no issue, there's no single frustration that's sort of bugging him at the moment. I think it's just the corrosive effect of a lot of smaller frustrations.
Yeah, and maybe this is something the Tour will look at. We both watched the French Open final. We heard what both Carlos and Jannik Sinner.
Sinner had to give a speech after he lost that match.
On that same red clay where he spent 5.5 hours and had three straight match points go the opposite direction. So, yes, I do think the Tour may need to look at this because, listen, other sports you have a cooling off period, some you don't get. I wonder if there's a sense that, you know, in that same tournament, Sabalenka did not come off so gracefully in the aftermath of losing to Coco Gauff and said, oh, you know, I had a bad day. It was all my mistakes. And there's also the chance to put your foot in your mouth when you are so disappointed.
Or a foot in a locker as it comes at Oakmont. What did you make of the Wyndham Clark situation?
I'm disappointed in that. A, I know members here of this golf club, and you're a guest, as Brandle said, and as I said earlier in this show, of Oakmont. You're a professional. You know, break your 9-iron. Yeah. You'll get another one in 5 minutes. Don't, you know, put your foot or whatever he did in the locker room. He's a professional athlete. He has incredibly high standards. He is no doubt crushed and disappointed with his play. But there are other ways, I think, whether it's punching your pillow in the hotel room or waiting to get into your car and scream and shout. But you don't do that here at one of these cathedrals of American golf where you are a guest. That's someone's locker. That's a member's locker you're destroying.
Yeah, I mean, all of these guys, are 156 guys in the field this week, they're all passionate, and they've all been kind of driven slightly to the edge of insanity by the U.S. Open. That's what this tournament is designed to do to them. But, you know, if that was your guest, if that was someone you brought to the club, you'd be absolutely mortified by the behavior. And it's nothing new. I mean, it's not even a month since Wyndham Clark tweeted his apologies over his conduct at the PGA Championship, where he destroyed a tee marker, and where he also then flung his driver and, you know, came dangerously close to a volunteer as well. And this was just on May 19th, and here we are on June 16th, and we have another issue with Wyndham Clark's behavior. And I get that everybody's passionate. I'm sure he's probably embarrassed by what happened here this weekend. But at a certain point, you're 31 years old. Grow the hell up.
Yeah, and an apology was made, and I guess another apology will be forthcoming, I imagine. It's not something he can't bounce back from. But
no,
this
is not a, you know, career-defining
behavior.
It's just a mild disappointment.
He won this championship 2 years ago.
And probably wanted to kick a locker in that week as well. That's what the U.S. Open does to you.
No doubt about it. Beautiful church pews at the 125th U.S. Open. How about the field performance this week? Scoring average 74, a little bit more than that. Total score to par. Look at that, 1,855 over. Look at the doubles or worse, 367. Total player at par or better, one. He, of course, J.J. Spahn. Great now to be joined by the president of Oakmont Country Club, John Lynch, on this Monday. Great to spend some time with you, John. So how does the president of the club kind of judge how the week went?
Well, we think it was an outrageous success. Wow. We are very pleased that it ended on Sunday. But leading up to it, the golf course was in just immaculate condition. We were worried about the rain that we were getting. But I think Mike McCormick and his crew just did an awesome job of keeping it where it needed to be in tournament shape and so forth. So we couldn't have been more pleased.
How happy are you that the golf course held up, not in terms of the conditions under tough weather, but just in terms of defending itself against the best players in the world?
You know, it's always a question, right? We don't have the length that a lot of the championship golf courses have, and so it's a concern. We personally felt, though, with the rough of what it was and so forth in our greens, that it would hold up well. Our prediction was if it got wet, it could go as high as or as low as -5 with dry conditions, +5. -1, man, right in the sweet spot. So we're really, really pleased to see the scores that were being shot.
You know, a lot of memberships around the country, members are wanting the golf course to play easier. You're like, I'm getting older. Get rid of that bunker here. You know, move that there. Move this tee box here. Why is the ethos here harder, harder, and harder?
Yeah, I think it's been in the DNA of the club from day one. You know, H.C. Phones built this thing in 1903, and he was kind of a crazy guy, too, saying, we want hard, we want hard. His son continued, we want hard. And this membership, it's just part of the DNA. They enjoy it hard. I like to say that, you know, when we play our game SWAT and so forth, when everybody's finished, nobody really talks about the good holes they had. They talked about the bad holes we had. Can you believe this? Can you believe that? Can you believe the break I got? So it's part of the DNA. They love tough, and they love to see all the best players in the world have a hard time with it as well, so we're pleased.
My spiritual home.
Yeah, you have.
Right here. John, the 18th green is just on the other side of the clubhouse here to our right. Have you been out there yet this morning to try to recreate the J.J. Spahn putt, or do you think that's going to become a thing for your members now?
I'm positive it'll become. I have not. I just arrived on property, but I am positive that will become, you know, something for all members to try. It when you think about it, how long that putt was, virtually impossible to make.
But I mean, what are the odds that you would have given J.J. Spahn sitting watching that yesterday?
I wouldn't give him 1 in 100. And I mean 64 feet, it's that hard of a putt. And he did get a nice little read off Victor, so that certainly helped. But for it to go in the hole, it was just his day, right?
Yeah, it was. And not every club wants to lose their golf course to a major championship. Oakmont, of course, one of three anchor sites for the U.S. Open. It will be back 2033, 42, 49. Why is that something the membership would say, yes, we want to continue to host the national championship and other big USGA events?
Well, you know, great point. You know, with this, that was our 10th U.S. Open, three more coming. It is something that we're very proud of, that the USGA decided that we're an anchor site. You know, we've got contracts here for through 2049. And it's just something we live for. It's important to have the Opens here. You know, John Boenheimer says it's important where these champions win their Opens, and they want to win their Opens at places like Oakmont. So we're incredibly pleased that they want to come back here, and we love it. also, the USGA has been flexible enough. We don't really lose the golf course for that long of a period of time, about 11 days.
Okay.
So that's all doable. So we're very, very happy to be an anchor site and to be hosting as often as we do.
I'm curious about that impact on the members. I'm genuinely surprised that it is only 11 days. But in terms of the infrastructure, it's an enormous infrastructure that goes up around this golf club. When does that process start, and when do you actually think as though you get back to normal here?
That's a great question. So it started months ago, and it'll probably be the end of July in that neighborhood, and weather dictates that too. So like for today, it's not going to be a great day to start, you know, having construction teams out there, you know, ripping things down. So there is inconveniences for probably in the neighborhood of 6 months. But again, it's just something that we're aware of, we know, we like, and we're willing to do this through 2049.
I'm fortunate to know a handful of members here at Oakmont, my good buddy Alan Citrin, Mike Bushkoff, we were talking about just a little bit. I've always found this club very welcoming. The members are fantastic by and large. Can you speak to that ethos here of the type of members that you want to walk through these doors every day?
No, it's, you know, even when we bring in new members today, we kind of believe in the philosophy of good to great. A book by Jim Collins, which is, you know, we've always been good. We've been good for 100 years. We want to get to great, and you keep reaching for that. And we're doing training from our pro staff down there to the wait staff up here. Everybody's in a program to try to get better every day of their lives. We want you to be a member for a day when you're a guest. And we want you to feel very comfortable, and I think we pull that off, and we're very proud of that.
Is it actually fun to play a golf course this difficult every day? I know we're all masochists as golfers, but is it fun?
We're masochists, so it can be tough. And again, if you're hitting that drive in that rough every single hole, there's zero fun with that. I got to be honest with you. You know, it's can you get that ball down the fairways and really play the holes? We enjoy that challenge of trying, and that is a really, as the best players in the world showed us, it's hard to hit the fairway every single hole. So that's the goal. You know, can you get it into the fairway? Can you get it on the greens? It is a very tough place to be your only club, I would say. You could probably go crazy.
Real quick, how about the head pros here? Devin Gee now, and of course Bob Ford, who was the first tee starter this week. How special to have that DNA in this club as well?
So, you know, so Bob, 40 years basically at Oakmont, wonderful man, you know, a real ambassador, known by everybody. Devin steps into, you know, his shoes and has just literally taken over right where Bob left off. And he's a super person that does the same thing of the good to great concept. He's always working with his staff and just making sure everybody's having a very, very special experience. So two superstar guys, and we're so lucky to have them both.
Last question, John. Do you send the repair bill to Wyndham Clark, or is that a USGA matter?
both. So this is it's disturbing, to say the least. It's an ongoing issue. We're going to have conversations with the USGA of where this goes, and very unfortunate. I wish it hadn't happened at Oakmont, but we really don't know what the outcome of this is going to be, but we're working with the USGA, and we want to have a joint decision on what we do there.
Unfortunate moment, but hopefully a teachable moment going forward, John.
Agreed.
It was a wonderful week here at Oakmont. Thank you for having us. We appreciate
it. Thank you all for being here, and thanks for allowing me to be with you today. Great talking with both of you.
John Lynch, president of Oakmont Country Club, which just hosted a record 10th United States Open at the Church Pews again. More U.S. Opens on the way. 2033 can't get here soon enough.